The following is a home program on the Bhagavad Gita as it is, chapter number 6, text number 33, given by His Grace Sriman Sankarshan Dasathikari, recorded on July 1st, 2011, in Melbourne, Australia.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Arjuna Uvacha.
Arjuna Uvacha.
Yoyam Yogastvaya Praukta. Samyena Madhusudana.
Samyena Madhusudana.
Etasyaham napashyami.
Etasyaham napashyami.
Chanchalatvat stitim stiram.
Chanchalatvat stitim stiram.
Arjuna said, O Madhusudana, the system of yoga which you have summarized appears impractical and unendurable to me, for the mind is restless and unsteady. Purport. The system of mysticism described by Lord Krishna to Arjuna, beginning with the words Suchal Deshe and ending with Yogi Padama, is here being rejected by Arjuna out of a feeling of inability. It is not possible for an ordinary man to leave home and go to a secluded place in the mountains or jungles to practice yoga in this age of Kali. The present age is characterized by a bitter struggle for a life of short duration. People are not serious about self-realization, even by simple practical means, and what to speak of this difficult yoga system, which regulates the mode of living, the manner of sitting, selection of place, and detachment of the mind from material engagements. As a practical man, Arjuna thought it was impossible to follow this system of yoga, even though he was favorably endowed in many ways. He belonged to the royal family and was highly elevated in terms of numerous qualities. He was a great warrior. He had great longevity, and above all, he was the most intimate friend of Lord Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. 5,000 years ago, Arjuna had much better facilities than we do now, yet he refused to accept this system of yoga. In fact, we do not find any record in history of his practicing it at any time. Therefore, this system must be considered generally impossible in this age of Kali. Of course, it may be possible for some very few rare men, but for the people in general, it is an impossible proposal. If this were so 5,000 years ago, then what of the present day? Those who are imitating this yoga system in different so-called schools and societies, although complacent, are certainly wasting their time. They are completely in ignorance of the desired goal. Vandeham Sri Guru Shijata Parakamalam. Sri Gurun Vaishnavamscha. Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raguna Tanvitam Tam Sajivam. Sadaitam Savadutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam. Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shivishakan Vitamscha. So Krishna has explained to Arjuna the Ashtanga Yoga system. Wherein Gauman goes to a secluded place. He leaves behind all material possessions. He gives up his relationship with his family, his friends, his house, all possessions are completely abandoned. No money, no bank account. He simply goes all alone to the wilderness and practices the asana, the deep breathing, etc. So Arjuna, even though 5,000 years ago, and he was greatly endowed with so many qualities of austerity and penance, longevity, so many opulences Arjuna had, but still he rejected this system. The Ashtanga Yoga system is not being practical. So what is the practicality for us? Who is prepared to go in the wilderness for the rest of their life? With no mobile phone, no laptop computer, no bank balance, no family members. Simply go to the wilderness. Who is prepared to do that? Only very rare men. And even we try to do, we're not very qualified. In our center in Austin, one Indian boy, he graduated from college. He said, "Now I want to be a yogi." So he went to the mountains in New Mexico. He went up in the mountains, he took off all his clothes, and he sat there naked, meditating in the cold. And he died. They found him dead there a few days later. He killed him. He wasn't accustomed to that austerity. He couldn't do it. He killed him. He died. His brother came and told us what had happened. They found him dead up there naked in the mountains. Just went up to meditate in the mountains naked. So it's not easy to do this sort of a yoga system as described in the Ashtanga. The Ashtanga Yoga chapter here, chapter 6, where it describes it in detail. But in this age, as Krishna points out in the very final verse of this chapter, yoginam api sarvesham madgatena taratmana shadavan mujite yomam same yukta tamomataha. Of all the yogis, the one who with great faith worships me in devotion is the most intimately united with me and is the highest of all. That is my opinion. So there is no loss if we're not able to do this Ashtanga system. Simply, if we can take to this path of bhakti yoga, we can get all the benefits of all the yoga systems. Bhakti yoga system is so very nice. You simply have to offer everything to Krishna. Yat karoshi, yat ashnasi, yat jahosi, dadasi, yat. Yat tapashashi konteya tat kadushva madarpanam. Whatever you do, whatever you eat, whatever you offer, give away, as well as whatever austerities you may perform, do that, O son of Kunti, as an offering unto me. That is not a difficult thing. If you're guided by an expert spiritual master, it's not difficult. If you eat, well, you offer your food to Krishna. Find out what Krishna accepts and offer those things. Don't offer something nonsense that Krishna refuses to accept. You have to find out what Krishna accepts and you offer those things. Some people say, well, why you don't offer onions and garlic? I mean, they're vegetarian. Well, we know from the acharyas that Krishna doesn't accept them. From great self-realized souls, and it's confirmed in the Manusmriti also, that onions and garlic are not suitable for eating. It's stated right there in the Manusmriti. Plus, they stink. They don't smell bad. If somebody has onion, just like if you want to get garlic pills at the health food store, they're deodorized. They deodorize them. Why? Because garlic stinks. So why would we offer something stinky to Krishna? Sometimes it smells bad with Krishna. See? Krishna wants very, he likes very delicious, sweet, delicious food, not stinky foods. So there are certain things we have to learn about what is acceptable to Krishna and what is not acceptable. So we learn that onion and garlic are not acceptable to Krishna. This is why we need the guidance of a bona fide spiritual master, why we need the guidance of advanced devotees, pure devotees of Krishna, who have no ulterior motive, who are simply engaged in Krishna consciousness for the pleasure of the Lord. If we learn from the pure devotees, we learn from the spiritual master, then we can be guided how to practice Krishna consciousness. Bhakti yoga is a student, is a housewife, as a professional man, as a businessman, as a military man, in any position. Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra, in any position. If one takes the guidance of a bona fide spiritual master, then one can become a highly competent bhakti yogi, devotee of the Lord. And in this way, become actually delivered from this material existence. You see. Right now, we're caught up in what's called, it's a syndrome, it's called indriya seva. You serve your senses. And the senses give you some temporary satisfaction. It's like scratching an itch. But after you scratch the itch, what happens? It itches even more, doesn't it? So we serve our senses, and then the senses, okay, now I want more. Dushparena nalena cha. The senses are never satisfied and they burn like fire. So you gratify your senses and then you get a little temporary relief for a brief period of time and then they say, okay, now more. And what is the end result of serving the senses? They say, well, now you, the material nature says, all right, if you want to serve your senses, I'll give you another body. Here, take another material body. You can serve your senses again. You see, the senses are not us. It's like you're wearing a shirt or a coat. Is that you? No. It's not you. It's just a garment that you're wearing. So this body is not you. It's just a garment that you're wearing. You see? If you take that garment to be yourself and you dedicate your whole existence simply to serving the external covering, you've missed the whole point of your existence. That's why people are frustrated and unhappy today. The whole culture that we live in is geared towards indriya seva, serving the senses. Therefore, nobody's happy. Even the most successful, powerful people, like the demigods, they're the most successful, powerful people in the whole universe. They're not even satisfied. The demigods aren't even satisfied. Even Brahma can't be satisfied unless he's a devotee. Abrahma bhuvana loka punara vartinarjana mam upechira kontiya punarjanma nivijate. From the highest planet in this material world down to the lowest, all are places of misery wherein repeated birth and death take place. But he who attains to Maya Bodha, son of Kunti, never takes birth again. So even if you're Brahma, that doesn't mean you're going to be happy. So what to speak of being a Bill Gates or a Stephen Jobs or something like that? You can't be happy in any position here. It doesn't matter how much money you have, how famous you are, how powerful you are. It doesn't matter. You're not going to be happy here as long as you remain entangled in serving your material senses. You'll never be happy. Because it's not us. It's not us. This body is not us. It's not our identity. We're eternal spiritual beings, qualitatively one with God. So if you want to be really happy, my dear ladies and gentlemen, you have to become self-realized. You have to become self-realized. The great sages of India, they have taught us this science of how to become self-realized. You have to become self-realized. Otherwise, you remain a miserable person. Rich or poor, sick or healthy, it doesn't matter. You're a miserable person. Unless you're self-realized. Atato brahma jigyasa. The Vedanta Sutra is telling you, now you got a human form, you must use it to become self-realized. You must. Otherwise you're not even a human being. If you're simply trying to make money in this material world, make a ninth of a to serve your senses and the seven senses of your family members, you're an animal. You're not a human being. The animals are doing that, aren't they? The bird is making a nice nest. He's gathering worms for the his mate and for the little baby worms. If all you do is make money and to make a house and make a nice facility for your family members' senses, you're no better than a bird. You're wasting your time. Shrama eva hi kevalam, Bhagavatam says. Any activities which are not for awakening the dormant, enlightened consciousness within, shrama eva kevalam, is simply wasting your time. So kindly don't waste your time. Do you realize how difficult it is to get a human body? There are 8,400,000 different species. And by the stringent laws of nature, you have to go through each and every one of those species. If only 400,000 are human, the other 8 million are plants, animals, fish, worms, reptiles, etc. You realize you had to go through 8 million different births before you got a human form? 8 million births? That's a lot of hell. To be an animal or a plant or a worm or a germ. You had to go through 8 million births before you had a chance to be a human being. So now do you want to use a human being, just a body to imitate the animals running after the sense desires? Do you want to do that? Do you want to do that? That'd be the greatest foolishness. To come all the way to the human body and use it for sense enjoyment. Be the greatest foolishness. Because human body, especially human body, and this earth planet, this is the best planet for self-realization. The demigods want to take birth here because they're so carried away by the heavenly pleasures in the Svargalok. They want to take birth here. What to speak to take birth in India, the land of the great sages, the land of Krishna. I mean, you talk about, the greatest opportunity that one could have to take birth in the Holy Land of India is the greatest opportunity. So if one simply runs after a job here in Australia, forgetting the great boon of being born in India, it's the greatest tragedy. And Shakespeare could write a drama about it. It's such a bad tragedy. Yeah, such a. It's the greatest tragedy. So, you've gotten this birth in India now. Take full advantage. Take advantage of your Indian birth. Hear from the bona fide spiritual master, inquire from the spiritual master, serve the spiritual master. And in this way, you see, Krishna guarantees that spiritual master reveal the truth to you. The spiritual master sees the truth. He's not a conditioned soul subject to the four defects. The spiritual master can see the truth. If you'll hear from him, you'll serve him submissively, you'll bow down to him. In this mood of submission and inquiry, spiritual master can enlighten you with transcendental knowledge. Completely open your eyes, you see. Therefore, we pray to the spiritual master. Om Agyana Timurandrasya Gananjana Shalakaya Shakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Nama. I offer my respectful obeisances under the lotus feet of my spiritual master, who has come to me while I am in the darkness of ignorance, and he is forcing my eyes open with the torchlight of knowledge. Spiritual master is a perfect soul. He has perfect knowledge of the Absolute Truth. And if we hear and serve from the bona fide Guru, he can open our eyes and give us perfect knowledge of the Absolute Truth. There is an Absolute Truth, by the way. Some people say there is no Absolute Truth. It's just relative, you see. There's no absolute truth. There's only relative truth, they say. But we have to ask them this. Are you absolutely sure of that, sir? They say, oh, yes, I'm absolutely sure there's no absolute truth. What do? They just contradicted themselves. You cannot state absolutely there's no absolute truth. Therefore, since the absolute truth is irrefutable, there must be an absolute truth. We can prove the existence of the absolute truth by the absurdity of its non-existence, philosophical absurdity of its non-existence. You cannot absolutely not have an absolute truth, you see. Therefore, the absolute truth must exist. And human life means you find out what is an absolute truth. The Vedanta tells us, janma-jasya-dataha, the absolute truth is that from which everything is emanating. It is the original source of the whole universe. The original source of existence itself is the absolute truth. You are an emanation of the absolute truth. You exist because the absolute truth is emanating you, not because your parents wanted to have a baby. That explains your material body. It doesn't explain you. You're an emanation of the absolute. And that's what you are. You see? And if we go deep into that absolute, we find that absolute is a person. And that person, his name is Krishna. This is not simply a sectarian viewpoint. Well, you know, that's your sect. No. Sarve Devarshir Nadastata Asito Devalavyasa Svayam Chaivam Ravishime. Arjuna explains in chapter number 10, text 13 of the Bhagavad Gita, that all the great sages are saying this, that you are the supreme personality of Godhead, the purest, the absolute truth, the eternal transcendental person, the unborn, the greatest. All the great sages are confirming this truth about you, such as Devarshi, Narada, Asita, Devala, and Vyasadeva. And now you, my dear Krishna, are today revealing the same truth to me. So what Krishna revealed to Arjuna was not something new. It had already been revealed by Narada Muni, Asita, Devala, Vyasa, and all the great sages. It all revealed these truths. So what we are understanding as truth is not some sectarian dogma. It is the science of the self in relationship with the Supreme Self, as taught by the greatest scientists in the history of the universe, Vedic scientists. They had perfect scientific knowledge of everything, the origin of the universe, and everything going on within the universe. So we shouldn't be deluded by these so-called scientists of the modern times, like this Dr. Stephen Hawking. He says the universe comes out of absolutely nothing. I ask you, is that scientific? Science means observation and experiment. Where is the experiment? You can take nothing and get something out of it. Do we have any scientists here in the room tonight? Physicists? Any physicists here? Any physicists? Chemists? Biologists? No scientists? Just computer science?
Microbiology.
So, can you create an organic? Can you create an organism out of nothing?
They're claiming nowadays that they the scientists are claiming nowadays that they are making cells
out of what?
Of course, out of matter.
Right, that's my point. They're taking something that's already there and then simply modifying it.
Yeah, yeah. Not the real cells.
They're not taking it out of nothing. That's my point. Yeah. They're not taking it out of nothing. They take nothingness and produce something out of nothing. But Stephen Hawking says the universe came out of absolutely nothing. There's no experiment to prove it. It's just his concoction. because he talks big, big words, and because they feel sorry for him because he's paralyzed, they applaud him as a great scientist. He can only talk by moving his eyelids, you see. So he blinks his eyelids in a certain sequence, and that's how he goes to a computer, and that's how he talks. Because he's paralyzed and he blinks his eyes in certain coded ways, they take him as a great scientist. But he's actually simply a speculator. I mean, I appreciate his gumption and his fortitude. I admire him for that. I admire him for his determination. But he's not a qualified scientist to actually know things as they are.
He said that
he's not qualified.
Black hole. He gave black hole theory. Black hole theory.
He gave the black hole theory.
Yeah, he's promoting the black hole theory. He's not the first one. The black holes, there may be black holes, there may not be black holes. That's not the point. The point is, you can't get something out of nothing. It's never been done. It's simply a theory. But they presented this speculative theory, they presented as the truth. That's the point. It's never been done. It's never been proven. In any laboratory, you can take nothing and get something out of it. Never been proven. It's simply theory. Everybody move forward. Squeeze as far forward as you can. Squeeze in tightly. We have people in the back who have no room to sit down. Everybody squeeze up. There's all this space in here. Everything just come all the way up. Fill this gap in here. Yeah, come on. Fill it all in the space, yeah. Yeah, that's right. So why should we take these persons as our authorities when they're not, they're just speculating, you see? That's not scientific. Scientist doesn't speculate. He observes things that are actually there and he draws conclusions from what he actually sees. Not what he imagines. What he can actually see. That's what he draws his conclusions from. See, that's real science. So I can see that everything comes from something. There's no case of something coming from nothing. Therefore, I can scientifically deduce that existence itself, the entire universe, the entire cosmic manifestation, therefore must also come from something. It doesn't come out of nothing.
At least some matter, at least. I mean, if
it comes from something.
Something.
Whether it's matter or antimatter, that's not the point. It must come from something. That's scientific. Just like Newton saw the apples. Every apple he saw was all the apple trees were dropping apples. He didn't see every apple in the world, but he saw so many apples that fell, including the one that hit him on the head, that he reached the conclusion of the law of gravity, you see. Because he saw so many instances where you could take something, you know, and you'd let go of it and it would drop. So he concluded the law of gravity, even though he didn't see every instance. But he saw enough instances that he was convinced it was true as a universal principle. So show me even one instance of something coming out of nothing. But a scientist, to be able to promote it as a valid theory, he has to show many, many instances in all kinds of circumstances that something comes out of nothing. But he hasn't shown even one instance that something comes out of nothing. So he's not being scientific. And it being promoted as science is a travesty of justice. It's not science. Science means you have to actually have, you have it demonstrated by an experiment. You have to be able to establish the principle by an experiment. And again and again and again in all kinds of situations. That's real science, you see. Empirical science I'm talking about. In genuine empirical science, you have to be able to, you know, with peer reviews and all kinds of stuff, you have to be able to show that again and again and again how this principle works. And then it's finally accepted as a theory, you see, as a bona fide theory, because you've proved it and you know, they all have tons of data to support your theory. But where is one even tiny fragment of data to support this theory that, that the universe comes out of absolutely nothing? There's not even one, not one piece of data to establish it. Nothing. It's simply a theory, a speculation.
The particle accelerator, the world will end. There was a rumor that the world will end because of the that experiment. That they are conducting experiment in Europe.
Yeah, so there was. Yeah, well, it obviously didn't happen. So.
And we were like terrorized. Oh my God, we'll die tomorrow maybe.
Huh?
When I was in India, there was a big rumor that experiment
would cause the world to end.
That experiment, I don't know the that was called Rider experiment.
The collider experiment.
A very long tunnel.
That's right. Yeah, they're spending millions and millions of dollars for this. Collide these particles, you know, in these big, in these tunnel under the ground, you see. While, you know, people are starving to death. And
yeah, people are starving, but they are actually putting millions and millions into that experiment.
And they're doing what?
The people are starving, but they're actually putting millions and millions of money into that experiment.
Yeah, that's right.
And they really don't know what can be the outcome.
The scientists are very well paid, by the way. They get very big fatty paychecks, you see. I had a friend one time who was getting his PhD in physics at the University of Oklahoma. And he told me that they get their money from the government for their, they say, well, this is what we've done in our scientific research, and now give us more money so we can keep doing our research. They're funded by the government. So they lied to the government about what they were doing. And the government doesn't know. They're just politicians. They have no idea about science. But they made all this big hype. He said they're lying. They were lying to get money from the government. They just lie. They create all these big lies, very sophisticated reports and everything. But it was a lie. Just to get more money from the government.
And if I'm not mistaken, I think Moon Voyage was also a hoax. Moon Voyage? Which they say that...
The moon landing?
Yeah, moon landing was a hoax.
Yeah, Prabhupada was not convinced that they landed on the moon. That's a fact. Although sometimes in his books he does mention about the moon landing as if it actually happened, because it's commonly accepted. He uses it as a point, a philosophical point sometimes. Sometimes he does talk as if we landed on the moon, but then in his conversations he said, actually, in his opinion, we did not go to the moon. He mentions in one place that they may have landed on the Rahu planet, which is actually an invisible planet. Vedic astrologers know about the Rahu planet because it has an astrological influence, but it's invisible. We can't see it. It's an invisible planet, from here anyway. Prabhupada, in his Bhagavatam purport, states that they may have landed on the Rahu planet instead of the moon, because the Rahu is a powerful demon and he can actually trick them. He has mystic powers. He could trick the NASA into thinking this was actually the moon. He has the power to do such things. So they could have landed on the Rahu planet, Prabhupada mentions in one of his purports in the Bhagavatam. Of course, there are scientists who claim that the whole thing was a hoax. You can go on the internet, and we actually, before the internet became big, we got some video, like 4 hours worth of video footage to prove that we never actually went to the moon. Yeah, the thing is, we blindly accept as truth what we see on television, but you know, how do you know it's really true? How do we know all these things are true that they say? They routinely talk about the Big Bang, and they say the universe. It's accepted. It's like on CNN, they'll talk about things that are accepted as truth, like the universe is something like 13 billion years old or 13.5 billion years old. But that's completely untrue. According to the Vedic scientists, the universe is 155 trillion years old. 155 trillion years old. 13.5 billion. They're way off. The scientists are way off. Their calculations are way, way off the mark. The universe lasts for 311 trillion years. And right now we're halfway through. When Mahavishnu exhales, all the material universes come into being, and when he inhales, they're destroyed. So right now, we're halfway in between his exhalation and his inhalation. He exhaled 155 trillion years ago, and now he's starting to inhale. So the universe will go on for another 155 trillion years, this universe, and then it'll be destroyed. So they really don't know what they're talking about. And they make fun of our scriptures like it's some fairy tales for little children. But actually, their science is fairy tales for little children.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there's science is fairy tales for little children. Yeah.
Pretty, some of the guests have written some questions.
Oh, yeah, bring the questions now. Pass the questions forward. Give me at least one to get started while the others are coming. Okay, good. All right. Hare Krishna. Why can't we just be good people? Because we can't be good people because we're being misled by bad leaders. That's why we can't be good people. We don't know how to be good people. We don't. We don't know how to be good people. Why can't we do good to others? We don't know how to. We don't know what is actual good is. That's the problem. Our so-called doing good is actually doing bad. We're harming. Because I think that I'm my body and I'm dealing with you as if you were your body. I may think I'm doing good to you, but actually I'm hurting you. I'm committing violence upon you. Do good to others as much as we can rather than following the austere path of bhakti where you have to give up so many things. Actually, we don't give up so many things. What do we have to give up? We still eat. We still mate. We still sleep. We still defend ourselves. And what are we giving up? Is it? Maybe we give up some nonsense activities that aren't worth the time. You see, once you get a higher taste, I may say, okay, here's $1 million. I just wanted to, I have a surprise for you. I'm going to give you $1 million. Here it is, heaven. It's yours now. You go, wow, $1 million. I can pay off my house or get a house if I don't have one yet. Not to worry about mortgage payments. You know, wow, it's great, $1 million. That's fantastic. Thank you very much. Oh, I was only joking. I really wanted to give you $1 billion, but you have to give the million back, and then I give you the billion. But I can't give up $1 million. I mean, I just couldn't do that. I mean, how could I give up $1 million? Come on, use your intelligence, sir. I'm going to give you $1 billion. So what's your million? What's your $1 million is insignificant compared to $1 billion, you see. So what are you giving up by taking up Krishna consciousness? What are you giving up? Some insignificant things that are a waste of time anyway. You see. So actually, but the bhakti path is not really that austere. It's not that austere. I mean, from my perspective, it's the path of enjoyment. I mean, I'm traveling all over the world, having a great time, sharing the science of Krishna wherever I go. You see, to me, bhakti is not some austere thing like sleeping on nails or something like that. You know. I mean, to me, it's the sweetest, most exciting adventure you could ever have. So I don't know what is this austere path of bhakti. I'm not following an austere path of bhakti. You see? I'm following the path of greater enjoyment, not the austere path of bhakti. No, I'm living a life of enjoyment. My every day is a celebration of transcendental bliss. Where's the austerity path? Huh?
Pig who eats stool, then if you put the halwa, it is austere.
I had to give up my stool? Austerity. I just can't give up eating my stool. Yeah. Well, first of all, it's not austere, and until you actually can deal with people on the spiritual platform, you're not doing good to anybody. You're not doing good to yourself. You're not doing good to anybody. You're hurting yourself and you're hurting everybody else. You're hurting your wife. You're hurting your kids. You're hurting your husband. You're hurting your family members. You're hurting your neighbor. You're hurting you're committing violence on everybody until you come to the spiritual platform, because you're reinforcing the false identity of the self. Why do we have to pass through 8 million bodies? Because, well, if you become Krishna conscious, you don't. But if you think that this material life is the enjoyment, you will continue to go body after body after body until you realize it's not. You will think, well, I try to enjoy material life in this way, and I wasn't happy, so let me try in this way, and this way. You get 8 million different ways to try it. You see? Okay. Why Krishna's bodily color is blue? Because Krishna likes blue. So. It's like today I bought a jumper. See? It's blue. I actually asked my wife, I said, what color should I get? She liked this color, so I got the blue, you see. So one chooses a color according to one's taste, or the taste of a dear one. It's like Krishna wants to please Radharani. She must be most attracted to blue, so, you know. Radharani likes blue the best, so Krishna manifests a blue body for Radharani, because he thinks it's the coolest looking color, blue, you see. How can I please Krishna through being a householder, grihastha woman? By doing everything for Krishna. It doesn't matter if you're male, female, brahmachari, grihastha. Same principle. Do everything for Krishna's satisfaction. You see, whatever you do, do it for Krishna. And then you'll be you know, cooking foodstuffs in your home and offering to Krishna. By making a nice altar in your home and offering daily arati to Krishna in this way. By chanting japamala, becoming initiated by a bona fide spiritual master who will train you how to become expert in Krishna consciousness. What are the steps needed by me to be taken immediately to fulfill my aim of life in pleasing Krishna? The steps are given by Rupa Goswami. Adau shraddha tata sadhu sangata bhajana kriya tato nartau navittishat tato nishtarujis tataha anasaktas tato atasaktas tato bhavas tato preman bhajanshati sadakanam yang premna pradurbhave bravet kramaha. These are the steps. The first thing is you have to have faith. The beginning, there must be faith. The second step is you associate, you become interested, associate with pure devotees. The third step is you become initiated by the bona fide spiritual master, who then engages you in executing the regulated principles of devotional service under his orders. The next step is you become free from all of your unwanted habits, and you become firmly fixed in devotional service. And then there's the awakening of taste and attachment. This is devotional service according to regulated principles. Then you move even higher to where you have an intensification of spiritual emotions within your heart, and finally the full development of Krishna prema. These are the steps. Some people consider that India's huge population is controlled by the Bhagavad Gita. That's not true. I wish it was. They don't follow the Bhagavad Gita. They follow the Bollywood and the politicians. That's who they follow, not the Bhagavad Gita. If India was following the Bhagavad Gita, it would be the most wealthy country in the whole world, as it formerly was. You know, India used to be the richest country in the whole world. You ever read the writings of the European trader called Marco Polo? You ever study the Western history about the trader and explorer Marco Polo? He went to India and he came back to Europe. He said, this is the wealthiest place in the whole world. India formerly was the richest, most powerful and wealthy place in the whole world when they followed the Bhagavad Gita. India has been dragged down the level of dogs and hogs by rejecting the Bhagavad Gita. Not by following the Bhagavad Gita, by rejecting the Bhagavad Gita.
I have a question.
What do you need?
Whoever asked the question, whoever's the question is, they said how they can immediately take the path of Krishna consciousness. You want to give them the instruction, what they can do?
I already did. We'll go back to that. Let me finish, and then we'll go back. Okay. Some people are against, I haven't finished the whole part, but are against Krishna considering him Satan. How to answer them in the correct way. If someone says Krishna is Satan, I wouldn't even bother talking to him. Because all you're going to do, they're a blasphemer, and all you're going to do, if you talk to them, if you feed milk to a snake, you simply increase his venom. If someone says Krishna is Satan, I wouldn't even bother talking to him. I would just the dogs will bark and the caravan will pass. I wouldn't waste my time with him, because you're going to increase his venom. That's all. Why you want to talk to somebody? If there's a dog barking, you go over and try to have a conversation with the barking dog. You just bite you. That's all. If somebody says Krishna is Satan, they're not even a human being. They're just like a barking dog. They consider the offering of food to Krishna is wrong. How to answer them? You don't need to answer them. But for your own understanding, you should know that they're talking about Christians. Satan is a Christian term. The Christians believe in Christ. The word Christ comes from the Greek word Christos, which comes from the Sanskrit word Krista, which is another word for Krishna. So these people have no philosophical brains whatsoever. They're completely ignorant of the science of God. They're sentimental fanatics. They have no spiritual knowledge. They engage in all sinful activities, and they say that they're holy. I mean, they're very low class people. They're called devotees in the mode of ignorance, and the Shastra says we should avoid their association. How to find a spiritual master for grihasthas? Well, a spiritual master doesn't depend on any ashram. Not that you have a spirit, that we have gurus for grihasthas, gurus for brahmacharis, no. The spiritual master is situated beyond the varnashram system. Whether he's a sannyasi or a householder or a married man, doesn't matter. The spiritual master is situated on the transcendental platform beyond the varnas and the ashrams. And whatever varna ashram you're in, he can guide you. So how to find a spiritual master is the more appropriate question. And that is, you have to see who is a living embodiment of the scriptures. And you have to, who can actually make you Krishna conscious? Who can train you how to become a pure devotee? That's the person you should accept as your spiritual master. Not simply somebody who speaks in flowery words and twirls a lotus flower in his hands and wears a long hair and a beard, you see. Who is actually Krishna conscious? That's who you take as your spiritual master. You see? Doesn't matter the ashram. Just like I'm a spiritual master, I have disciples all over the world. I have disciples who are brahmacharis, who live in a van and do full-time book distribution. Very, very dedicated brahmacharis, living very austere brahmachari life. And I have householders and I have many devotees who are householders, disciples who are householders also. It doesn't matter what your ashram is or what ashram your spiritual master is in. The point is, you find a guru who is Krishna conscious, who can inspire you in Krishna consciousness, and you surrender to him. That's all. Now we'll go back to the first question that you wanted us to talk further about. How to mainly fulfill my aim in life. The steps needed. The first step is, according to Rupa Goswami, a Dalgarashvayam. You have to take shelter of a bona fide spiritual master. That's the very beginning. Because that's when you really become fixed up, you see. Without a spiritual master, you're like a street dog. But if you have a guru, you're like a dog with a master. Now you're well situated. You have to take a master, follow his instructions, and then you're solidly situated in the transcendental path. In Krishna consciousness, we learn to remain humble. How can we remain humble and represent ourselves at the same time? Sometimes people complain, well, you know, Krishna consciousness is not good because you have low self-esteem. But actually, no, we don't have low self-esteem. That's not true. We have no self-esteem. But we have the greatest esteem for what we represent. You see, I consider myself to be lower than the stool of the pig. You see? I have no self-esteem, but I have the greatest esteem for what I represent, this knowledge I represent, this Srila Prabhupada whom I represent, this ISKCON movement that I represent. I have the greatest esteem. And therefore I can roar like a lion to defeat the nonsense scientists, because you're not nonsense. You're a good scientist. But I can, the ones who use science to promote atheism, that's what I'm talking about, to push atheism down our throats in the name of science. Science doesn't actually disprove God's existence. Real science doesn't do that, you see.
Against God.
Huh?
Scientists don't believe in God.
They don't. In general, they're atheistic, yeah. There are some who are theistic. It's like the ones who are promoting intelligent design, for example. They lean towards theism, and they feel it's scientific, and it is scientific. But science, in general, is the general thrust. The mainstream science is promoting atheism. That's it. If you're a theistic science, you're considered a kook by mainstream science. So I consider myself to be lower than the stool of the pig. When it comes to philosophy, I act like a king, and nobody can defeat me. I'm able to defeat all of them because I represent the highest truth. You see, so We're not interested in representing ourselves. We're interested in representing Krishna. Of course, if you're going out to get a job, you can hype yourself up as much as you want. That's cool. It's like when you go for a job interview, you know. You have to convince them you're the greatest asset they could, you know, the company could ever have, you know. Even though you know you're not that great, but for getting the job, you got to hype. For getting a job and that kind of stuff, sure, hype. Or you're a businessman, you can use all the hype you want. This is the greatest used car that's ever been sold in the city of Melbourne. You know what I'm saying? For those kind of purposes, for earning a livelihood, you can hype yourself as much as you want. It's okay. Well, devotees are allowed to hype themselves up as much hype as you possibly can to cover your material situation. That's all right. When it comes to philosophy, we consider ourselves to be absolutely lower than the star in the street. But we roar like lions to defeat this knowledge, to defeat the rascal philosophies which have destroyed the human civilization. Often we come across many material situations where we are happy in such conditions that it is very hard to think about Krishna. What should be our consciousness in such circumstances? Remember that they are temporary. If you become enlivened by a material situation,
you're answering the question that she has asked and she's not here.
Oh, the one who asked it. This is her question. She stepped out. Did she leave permanently or just for a minute?
Those were her questions.
These are someone else's questions.
Oh, you got a different page.
Yeah.
So, what should we do in such situations? First of all, remember they're only temporary. In other words, there's a good word in English, the word giddy. It means frivolous lightheartedness. If you something really goes good and you get all like intoxicated and bubbly and giddy, you know, you're just setting yourself up for being depressed, you see. Because as soon as the situation, you're basing your happiness on some temporary situation. And as soon as that turns the other way, you're going to go to an emotional roller coaster in the opposite direction. So instead of being happy by the temporary good things that happen in the material world, which only means you're going to be depressed when the things go the opposite side, you have to learn to be equipoised. You have to see everything as the mercy of Krishna, the good, the bad, the beautiful, and the ugly. See it all as Krishna's mercy. Learn how to use everything for your advantage to be Krishna conscious. That's the key. In other words, we don't say don't be happy. We say don't base your happiness on false things that are only temporary. Base your happiness on that which is eternal and which never changes. And then your happiness will never be diminished by any situation. This is intelligence, you see. Base your happiness not on some temporary upswing of the material nature. Base your happiness on that person who is beneath or within or who is the source of the material nature. That's Krishna. Often we are very enthusiastic as we're hearing such nice classes. However, soon that enthusiasm fades away. How to always stay enthusiastic? That's why you have to get initiated. You have to make a commitment to the spiritual master. Because then it's you're locked in 24 hours a day. Not just when you're sitting in the class. Now you're locked in. I've committed myself to my guru, and now I belong to him. Every thought has to be for him. Every word has to be for him. Every action has to be for him in all times, places, and circumstances. And then you, because I know, Prabhupada, when I accepted Prabhupada as my spiritual master, he wrote me a letter. He said, I told him, I said, Prabhupada, I really want to spread this movement. I wrote him a letter. And he wrote me back. He said, I can see you're a very sincere and enthusiastic boy, eager for spreading this Krishna consciousness movement. Now continue enthusiastically as you were doing, and surely Krishna will bless you. So I've been enthusiastic for the last 40 years. I got initiated in 1971. Thank you, Vrindavan. Because I committed myself to my spiritual master. Therefore, it wasn't only when I was in his class. I'm always in Prabhupada's class. I'm always sitting, within my heart, I'm always sitting in his lotus feet and taking and hearing his lectures. At every minute, I'm taking instructions from Prabhupada within my heart. So when you take diksha from a bona fide guru, and you really take it seriously, you're always in class 24 hours a day, hearing his instructions. He's guiding you at every minute. Just like Prabhupada is guiding me right now as I'm speaking to you. I'm not just speaking off the top of my head. Krishna is all-powerful. Then why does he need devotees to take care of the material, devatas to take care of the material world? Well, because he's all-powerful, he uses the devatas so he can play the flute. He could personally do, but he'd rather play the flute and sit around with Radharani and have some nice pastimes with Radhika. How to control our desires, material desires, how to overcome this. You just got a spirit. We don't say give up your desires. Just offer them to Krishna, you see. You have a desire to write poetry, write poems about Krishna. You have a desire to make $1 billion, become a billionaire for Krishna and build temples, you see. You have a desire to have a big family, or have a bunch of kids and make them devotees, you know. Whatever you desire, do it for Krishna. You don't have to give up desire, just offer it to Krishna. How to control the mind? By doing that, offering all your desires to Krishna. Why Krishna doesn't give me remembrance of our position in the spiritual world? You want to remember who you are in the spiritual world? Krishna will give you that remembrance. You just have to qualify yourself, that's it. In the higher stages of bhakti, you will remember who you were in the spiritual world. You remember exactly. You realize your sarup. That will come at a certain stage. You want it? All right, now work for it and earn it. You have to become pure. You have to, first of all, become completely free of all impurities, anartha nirvritti. In the higher stage, you'll actually remember who your sarup, who you are in the spiritual world. That comes in the higher stages. Why do we serve Krishna? Because it's such a good deal. That's one. It's really a good deal. Is that your question? No? Huh?
Little boy's
question. Was it his question? Yes. It was, okay. Why are there big temples with expensive marble and et cetera, where there are many poor people in need of food, clothing, and shelter? Actually, the biggest expensive marble is the banks nowadays. The other ones that really have the opulent buildings, the banks. The thing is, we're all in a Vedic society, the poor people, there is no poor people. Everybody is well-fed, even the animals. There's no, in India, how many well-fed animals do you see nowadays? Practically every animal you can see their ribs sticking out. They're all skinny. Even the animals in India are skinny. You ever seen a well-fed animal in India? Even the animals are skinny, you see. But in a Vedic culture, the animals, even the animals are all fatty and jolly, you see. What to speak of all the human beings. So in a Vedic society, there's beautiful temples and everyone's well fed. So why are we building temples now when people are hungry? First of all, we're feeding people at the same time that we're building temples. We have so many food distribution programs all over the world. The big temple is there because actually we're all poor in love of God. And because the temples help us to become God conscious. So we're starving. People are starving for lack of food. We're also starving for lack of Krishna consciousness. That is the greatest starvation of all, the lack of Krishna consciousness. Even if you're well-fed, you have no Krishna consciousness. What's the good of being well-fed? Just become a pig in your next life. So we have to save people from both kinds of starvation, spiritual starvation and food starvation. How to put Krishna as the center of my grihastha life? That's very simple. You have to everything. You have to raise. You have to turn your home into an ashram, where all the food is offered to Krishna. Nobody eats anything unless it's offered to Krishna. There's regular aratis going on every day on your altar. In every, the whole home atmosphere is for cultivating Krishna consciousness of the family members. What is it?
In regard to the previous question, why we are so against making the temples when we see there are big, much bigger buildings for sense gratification?
So her question is, why is somebody so opposed to big temples when we have no objection to all these big buildings for sense gratification? Just like here in Melbourne, there's one temple there on Dank Street, whatever it's called, and you drive downtown, there's huge, opulent buildings everywhere. Hotels, office buildings, everywhere, hundreds of huge, opulent buildings, and we complain because there's one opulent temple? I mean, what sort of mentality is that? This is atheistic mentality. There's how many millions of dollars of opulent buildings are all over the world? The UN, the Capitol building, the White House, these opulent buildings, and we complain because there's some temple for God? It's a ridiculous complaint. How can we understand perfectly when our senses of perception is very limited and our senses are imperfect? This is when I was a before I joined the movement, I asked the same question of the devotees. I challenged them. The you Hare Krishna people, you say that our senses are imperfect. Okay, so how, with your imperfect senses, do you know that Krishna is God? And that I met a devotee out on the college campus, the University of Berkeley, University of California, Berkeley. And I challenged him. You Hare Krishna say your senses are imperfect. So how do you know Krishna is God? It's your imperfect senses. He went, I defeated him. He couldn't answer me. I was a pretty proud character. I defeated the Hare Krishna. Of course, now I know the answer. And if it's somebody attacks me, I can defeat them. So this now, the same question is being asked of me, and I can easily answer it because I know the answer. The answer is, actually, you have perfect senses. But right now, they're covered by imperfection. But by the process of chanting Hare Krishna on the tongue and by honoring Krishna Prasadam, all of your senses become purified, so that with your purified senses, you can directly perceive God in due course of time as your senses become completely perfect. See Krishna face to face, eye to eye. You will directly perceive God. It's just a matter of purification, that's all.
Pruja.
Yeah.
I had a question on this.
Okay.
When as you said, the senses are covered, and when they get purified, then you can perceive the spiritual, the spirituality, or you can perceive. So are we saying that this material body on top of the spiritual senses is that, or is that the consciousness we are talking about?
Well, the spiritual body right now is in a dormant state. It's in a seed-like condition. Right now, the actual spiritual reality is a spiritual spark within the heart, which is has no physical dimensions, or it's sometimes stated to be 1/10,000th the tip of a hair. It's an insignificant particle, insignificantly tiny particle within the heart. That's the actual spiritual reality. But that spark of spirit is there within every living thing, and that's what's animating the whole material existence. So the more your senses become purified, the more you can actually see the underlying spiritual reality. It is there. There's a spiritual energy within this material energy, which is animating it. Without the spiritual energy, this material world would be just dead. Nothing would move here. What causes things to move and happen here is the spiritual energy. You understand? Yeah. Does that answer your question? Okay. Many times of performing devotional service, I think, why am I doing what I'm doing? Shouldn't I just go and enjoy with my other friends who seem to be so happy? Note the words seem to be so happy. Actually, they're not. The happiness in this material world is fake happiness. People are pretending to be happy. No one's actually happy. Don't be misled by the illusory happiness of this material world, so-called happiness. People are just acting as if they're happy. And there's no one's actually happy here. Everyone's miserable here. People are deluded into thinking they're happy. No one's actually happy. They just think they're happy. It's false happiness. If someone who actually knows what is real happiness, they will never accept this material sense gratification as happiness. Once you've tasted actual happiness, and you know how wonderful and how sweet and how enlivening it is, how unlimitedly thrilling it is, you'll never take this cheap so-called happiness again. So whoever wrote this, you're just not going deep enough into bhakti. You're skimming the surface right now of the bhakti ocean. You need to take shelter of a bona fide spiritual master. You need to go deep into the ocean of bhakti, and then instead of being envious of your friends for their so-called enjoyment, you'll feel sorry for the poor creatures. These poor souls, how they're wasting their time frivolously, watching Hindi movies and this and that. You feel sorry for them. What can I do to help these poor people? Is it?
Just one question on that.
Huh?
Just one question on that. It's very hard to see those people not very happy, those who are like staying with us, or used to stay with us, earning good money, or an apparently comfortable life. And
right. Well, you just got to, you haven't developed a very deep vision yet. That's all. You're not very enlightened, Prabhu. That's the thing. If you're still thinking, well, they got money, they have prestige, they have good facilities, you're seeing in a very limited and superficial way. You have to deepen your own vision by hearing more, by reading the scriptures more, by going deeper into the Maha Mantra, your realizations are not very deep. You got to deepen your own realizations. You understand? Yeah. Okay, how to use the profession in the service of Krishna. Somebody is a dietitian. She wrote me the other day, said, well, I'm a dietitian. How I can use that for Krishna? And I told her, well, you have to teach people how Krishna conscious diet is. They should have a Krishna conscious diet. I mean, what a perfect profession. Even if you can't talk about Krishna, you can say, well, first of all, you can teach them eating meat is bad. There's so much scientific data you can use. Say, well, this meat eating is bad. You should go on a vegetarian diet. And if you can offer that food to whatever the principle of God, you know, whatever your religion is, you can offer that food to God before you eat it. And that will purify your consciousness and sanctify your consciousness. So it's a great facility to be a dietitian and use it for Krishna. And any profession makes money, so use that money for Krishna. If you can't directly engage the profession for Krishna, then use the result of the profession for Krishna. Profession means money, so spend the money for Krishna. Don't spend it for sense gratification. Why God does not satisfy all our prayers in time? Give me a Cadillac, a brand new Cadillac, replete with Michelin tires. Give my wife a new silk sari, Give my kids a Harvard education. Give me a house by the sea. Om Jaya Jagadisha Hari. Why God doesn't do it? Doesn't He love me? Actually, when God doesn't give you, yeah, it's His mercy. See, you're praying for so many material things that God doesn't give you. That is His kindness. Because these things will never satisfy you. But real, only thing that will actually satisfy you is the love of God. And then Krishna, if you have pure love, Krishna will give you everything you need. Because you don't have pure love, therefore He's kindly holding back. And that's what's happening.
Is He holding back, or you are getting what you deserve it? Is He holding back, or you get what you deserve it?
Both. Because they're asking for so many things, and He's not giving it.
Yeah, but if one doesn't deserve it...
It's the same. Actually, both are true. Mm-hmm. Both are true. The fact is, you only get what you deserve according to your karma. So if your karma is to become a birla, you'll become a birla. Your karma is to be a sweeper in the street, you'll be a street sweeper according to your karma. Yeah.
I had a question on that. you know, we hear that for devotees, Krishna takes care of their karma, and their karma comes through the hand of Krishna, so as they
according promise, to the degree of their surrender.
Okay. So my question was going to be, at what point He does that, but you mentioned it.
Yeah, it's according to the degree of surrender He does that. When you become completely pure devotee, then Krishna personally supplies you everything you need. Sri Prabhupada says He delivers it to your door, whatever you need, when you're completely pure devotee. But until that point, it was some transition, you know, it's a gradual transition. Have you seen and spoken with Krishna? When will we be able to speak with Krishna like the way we speak to you? Well, first of all, those who have actually see and speak with Krishna don't talk about it. So you have no way of knowing whether I can see Krishna, whether I can speak with Him or not. You have no way of really knowing, because if I am doing that, I wouldn't tell you. You see. Either way, I'm not going to say that I'm doing it. If I'm not seeing Him and not speaking with Him, I'm not going to say that I am. And if I am speaking with Him and I am seeing Him, I'm still not going to say that I am. Because that's what Prabhupada taught us, you see. We would ask Prabhupada about these things, and he'd say, that you do not require. Actually, it's more important to, instead of wanting to see God, it's more important to try to act in such a way that God will see you. That's more important. So, when will we be able to see? According to the degree of your purity. Krishna's already there, you see. He's already there. And we're already seeing Him, but we're seeing our vision is blurry right now. Just like some of you have, I see you have glasses on. Take your glasses off for a minute. Does it look more blurry now? Yeah. Okay. I'll put them on again, you see. So you were seeing me without the glasses, but I looked quite different, didn't I? I was blurry. So actually we're all seeing God at this very minute. But we're seeing Him in a blurry way. We're seeing the material energy. You see? The material energy is a blurred version of the spiritual energy, actually. So by taking up this process of Krishna consciousness, then you're purifying your vision. And gradually, the blurriness goes away and Krishna will come into focus and you'll see Krishna. It's a gradual process. Gradually, Krishna, your vision will come into focus and you'll see God. So that's how it works. Yeah?
And for the devotees, Krishna doesn't give because knowing Krishna knows everything, so sometimes he doesn't give us because it can take away. They can forget Krishna consciousness and
default. That was the point I made a few minutes ago. Yeah, previously, that's right. Krishna kindly, how to focus on chanting. Well, you just have to remember how much nectar there is in these two syllables, Krishna. There's so much nectar in Krishna that one little mouth and one little set of ears is not big enough to capture the unlimited ocean of nectar. So you just have to remember how much nectar there is in Krishna, and then you definitely stay focused. My mind says there are other priorities, but Krishna, our programs, our association with devotees. Well, your mind is a rascal, you know. You have to intelligently understand from the scriptures and from the spiritual master and the sadhus what are the priorities. Stop listening to your mind. The mind will mislead you every time. I just don't have the time to chant. A taste of chant, but I like the Bishop philosophy and the philosophy how to chant. Well, let me ask you: do you have time to eat? Don't you? Somebody too busy to eat. Anybody here too busy to eat? Everybody eats. So, are you the body or are you the soul? What feeds the body? Food feeds the body. What feeds the soul? Chanting. So why would you starve your soul and feed your eternal soul and feed your temporary body? Is that a very intelligent thing? So stop being a fool, that's all I can say. Stop being a fool. Chant Hare Krishna. Why do we offer food to Krishna? If you had a roommate who was supplying all of your food. The refrigerator was always well stocked, the pantry, the one fully stocked with food. And you sit down to eat, would you say, you know, your roommate's name was, you know, such and such. My dear roommate, oh, thanks for all the food. And you eat, and you don't invite him to eat with you. What sort of roommate would you be? That's Christianity. Say, God, thank you for the food, but they don't offer it to him. And the Christians thank God for the food, but they don't offer it to him. That's like saying, my roommate's provided me all this food, and I sit down and eat. Oh, thanks a lot for all the food. And you don't offer it any to him. You see, that's Christianity. They eat it, but they don't offer it to him. Even though he's given everything, they don't offer him anything. I'm going to eat it all, but oh, thanks for it. You see, what sort of love of God is that? You don't offer, he's given everything, you don't offer him anything? That's not a very good thing. If somebody's giving you a full refrigerator full of food, your pantry, would you sit down and eat without offering some to him? No, we offer to him first. It's a natural sentiment. He's providing everything, of course you're going to offer to him. If you don't offer to him, you're not even a human being, you're just a dog, that's all. We offer to God because we're not dogs. We're human beings. That's the answer. We're not dogs. That's the answer.
They would say that he's God. God doesn't feel
hungry. Huh?
Yeah.
They would say that God, he's God. He doesn't feel hungry. We are human beings, so they don't need to offer him.
How do you know he's not hungry? How do you know? How do you know he's not hungry?
They say he's God.
What is your proof that God is not hungry? Huh? What's your proof? That's your opinion.
That's what they argue.
Yeah, okay, they argue that God is not hungry. So what's their proof that God is not hungry? You think God doesn't like to eat? Haven't you read the Srimad Bhagavatam? How Krishna relishes this? If God doesn't eat, why does he say in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 9, text number 26, Patram pushpam palam tayang yome bhakta prayachati tadahang bhakti praharitam mashnami prayatatmanaha. If you will offer me your love and devotion, a leaf, flower, food, or water, I will accept it. If God is saying, is asking you to offer to him, how you can say he doesn't want to eat?
Whatever you eat, give it to
him. That is your nonsense concoction. You, I'm telling not you, but that person who's saying that. You should tell them, this is your nonsense concoction. Krishna directly saying.
They say it's not written in the Bible that they should offer.
In the Bible? The Bible says that the Christian philosophy is it's better to give than to receive. So why are you simply receiving from God and not giving to God? You're not following your own Christian philosophy. Cool. According to Christianity, it's better to give than to receive. So why are you not giving anything to God? You're only receiving from God. That's not a good Christian. If you're really a Christian, you'll give to God. You'll be more interested to give God than to just take from God and thank Him. You're more interested to give. So we are better Christians than you. Because we are giving to God first and then receiving. But you're simply receiving. We are giving first. So we are better Christians than you. Next question. That's it? Right, the questions, when the questions run out, that means it's time for me to go. And we thank you all very much for your participation. We hope that you'll take this process very seriously. How many of you are chanting 16 rounds regularly?
Not the initiated. New bhaktas. You know, those who are initiated, they chant 16 rounds.
How many are who are not initiated are chanting 16 rounds? Oh, you're initiated. Oh, that's right. You're practically initiated. He's formally sheltered, so he's been approved for diksha, but we're just waiting until I get a few more, and then we're going to do a big yagya in December. So apparently he's like an initiated disciple. He was already recommended, but officially approved by the temple, by Aniruddha. He's already apparently initiated. But just waiting, just the yagya awaits him. But we encourage all of you to take this process very seriously. Take shelter of the bona fide spiritual master. There are many nice spiritual masters in our society who represent Prabhupada very nicely. So just take shelter of one of these spiritual masters, whoever inspires you the most in your Krishna consciousness. Follow his instructions as your life and soul. And in this way, make your lives perfect. Okay, we thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.